My friend, the Reverend Howard Jenkins of Bethel AME Church over on Rochambeau, said to me recently, knowing ourselves and knowing each other means knowing our history. And I thought he could not have said a more timely as well as meaningful thing. And this is why I am preaching three sermons, one on each century of our 300 years. Many thanks to our history committee, and especially our brilliant unofficial church historians who have worked with me to share and present a wealth of information and resources. Robert Owen Jones, I would like to ask you guys to stand up because you deserve this congregation's thanks for all your work. Robert Owen Jones and Janet Downing Taylor and Phyllis Cole. Janet, up you come. Phyllis, up you come. Yes, up you get. And also to Louise Sloan and Kelly Smith and Phyllis again, so you can just stay standing. For their recent work to bring on a scholar to look at our history in regards to race and slavery here in Rhode Island. After a long time of unknowing, we have organized this project to research the history of this congregation, both around race generally and particularly the slave trade, which was so prominent for so long in Rhode Island's economy and society. The Prudential Committee approved funds for a researcher and a Harvey so that we can learn what we need to know about this piece of our own beloved church's heritage. And already information is coming to light. It is a big deal. And what comes of it will be important and sometimes painful to process. And we are not afraid to know the truth, nor to confirm what we had every reason to expect. It is part of our story. And as we learn, we begin to reckon with it together. Most of the scholarship in this sermon has been done by all those folks we just thanked. However, if there are mistakes in this review of our history, I truly do believe they are my own. And rather than focus wholly on covenants and ministers, though they are essential in our story, I am including also some lesser known and brandly new discovered aspects of our history. Of course, given that this is our 300th birthday, our church began in 1720, when what was then known as the Third Church in Boston, now Old South Church, supported a small group of Congregationalists from in and around Providence to start a church down here. Congregationalism. It evolved from Puritanism and separatist movements. Congregationalists believed that congregations should be autonomous and self-directed, independent of any larger hierarchies dictating leadership or theology, instead able to establish themselves and choose or change their own leadership and beliefs. In that spirit, these people gathered to form a congregation served by visiting ministers. Over the course of this sermon, you'll see, already we've seen, were you listening to that covenant from 1728? You will see how much things have changed, but when you hear that spirit that called this congregation into being at all, you surely hear also how much has endured. Just 3 years later, in 1723, they built their first meeting house at the corner of College and Benefit Streets, where the county courthouse now sits. In 1728, the church gained, as you heard, both the first covenant and the first minister. The covenant was signed by those nine men codifying the first congregational church, which, if you were listening carefully, you noticed probably it was both Trinitarian and Calvinist, which is exactly the opposite of our modern Unitarian and Universalist, universal salvation, theology that is embedded in our name now. How things change. But of course, there's also the commitment to love our neighbors as ourselves, which was in there, to grow in grace and divine knowledge, and, boy, do we need to hear this now, persevere to the end the things we believe in. And also that year, the Reverend Josiah Cotton was called as minister. He served almost 25 years, growing the church and extending its membership to include Native people and people of color. From Reverend Cotton's record, we know that in 1729 or 30, A servant named Elizabeth, who was the daughter of a black man and a white woman, was baptized into the congregation. We can tell that baptizing people of different races and heritages was something that Reverend Cotton did intentionally and with some degree of courage. His notes tell us that on Christmas Day 1742, much later, he baptized and welcomed into covenant Anne, who he describes in his notes, and I'm using original language here as long as it doesn't include words that we have outright refused to speak nowadays. He describes her in his notes as the Negro woman servant of Colonel Jabez Brown, and Hannah Newfield, who he says was a free Indian woman. Reverend Cotton includes in his notes from that day the text that he preached from that morning. It was Acts 10, 34 to 35. I think that says it all. No? Then Peter began to speak to them. I truly understand that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, anyone who fears him and does what is right is acceptable to him. Anyone is acceptable to him. Reverend Cotton led the church until 1747, which included a wrenching congregational split in 1743, perhaps not coincidentally, a very few years before he left. The hot theological issue of the day, because yes, theology has hot issues. The hot theological issue of the day was whether it was good deeds or pure faith that would save you from hell. Some believed true faith was all that God required, and this is what Calvinism included, what Calvin and Martin Luther, two 16th century theologians, taught. Others thought that faith alone did not suffice at all, that real faith had to be fulfilled through deeds, both as proofs of the faith and to further the kingdom of God on earth. I know you guys probably haven't heard this joke that a lot of ministers love about a minister who never did live what he preached. So he dies, and of course he goes to hell for his hypocrisy. And he's walking around meeting a lot of historic bad guys, Herod and the Marquis de Sade and folks like that. And then, to his shock, he recognizes Martin Luther walking along with John Calvin. And he goes up to them and he says, "Why, Martin Luther, John Calvin, I can't believe it. You spent your whole lives in the service of faith. What in the world are you doing here?" And both Luther and Calvin look down at the fiery coals underfoot and mutter resentfully, "It was deeds." I know, it's super funny. Anyway, faith versus deeds. Super hot in the 1740s, speaking of hell, so hot that it split this church. Because the Calvinists were all about faith, but Reverend Cotton was increasingly about deeds. New light preachers were traveling through New England, embracing a new quality of emotion and immediacy in religious experience, and reaffirming the message of salvation by faith. And their work fueled the fire of the Calvinist dissenters in the congregation. And though Reverend Cotton tried to build bridges with him, he was unsuccessful. And those dissenters, led by a guy named Deacon Joseph Snow, left to cross the river and form what is now Beneficent Congregational Church. And because the record of all this was set down by one of those Calvinist-oriented folks, which is the only instance I've ever personally encountered of history being written by the losers, because most of the people stayed here, but it went down even in our own annals as the result of Reverend Cotton preaching damnable good works. People here did not take any of this well and censured Beneficent. Although, as you will hear, some retained ties in business after those of theology were severed. But the split had been devastating on many levels. And when Reverend Cotton left a few years later, the congregation was unable to call another minister until 1752. Right before that happened, sometime around 1751 or 52, a man named Samuel Nightingale Sr., founder of the Providence Nightingale family, joined this church and became a prominent member. beginning a long and deep relationship between this congregation and generations of the Nightingale family. Early in his life, Mr. Nightingale had been a minister. But by the time he came here, he was in business, including primarily a new rum distillery. And Mr. Nightingale owned a very successful rum distillery. And the implication of this is that his money came from what is sometimes called the triangle trade, whereby ships from the east coast of what was then the colonies took sugar, tobacco, cotton, and rum to Europe, and then brought textiles, rum, and manufactured goods to West Africa, and then took enslaved people across to the Americas, where they were exchanged for sugar, cotton, and so forth, which was brought up to New England, and then across the ocean to restart that cycle again. And census records show that Samuel Nightingale and his son's families all had both enslaved and free people of color working in their households. Just after or around the time that Samuel Nightingale joined in 1752, the congregation called its second minister, another deeds preacher, John Bass, the Reverend John Bass. He served for 6 years, and the church was still in uncertain circumstances, recovering from the split. Reverend Bass's income was extremely small. To supplement his pay, he went into partnership with Deacon Snow from Beneficent and Samuel Nightingale from this church in the new Concord Distill House, manufacturing that rum for the triangle trade. Reverend Bass left the church in 1758. The church continued with the traveling preachers working to continue to reestablish itself amidst all this theological change, which resulted in a second covenant in 1761. And this was effectively a reboot of the church. It was signed by 21 individuals, including 10 women. I know. I'm now going to read their names. Sarah Whipple, Phoebe Bagley, Mary Bass, Abigail Nightingale, Mary Allen, Mary Manning, Sarah Burr, Dorothy Reynolds, Mildred Frothingham, and Grace Teal. In this new covenant, many of the Calvinist elements of faith were removed, and Jesus was identified not as the Son of God, but as a mediator between humanity and God. So that was drastic. Among the signers were some whose names we recognize also from the byways of this city, Resolved Waterman. And some I've already mentioned, Samuel Nightingale. Also, Darius Sessions, who we have learned was the co-owner of a slave ship. And Jabez Bowen, who co-owned the slave ship Prudent. A year later, in 1762, still fiscally insecure but determined to move on, the congregation called the Reverend David Sherman Rowland. And within a few years, it was clear that more was required to stabilize the church's finances. So in 1770, the Benevolent Congregational Society was formed to help raise funds and hold property on behalf of the church. Many of the men who signed that 1761 covenant also founded this society with their donations, along with Samuel Nightingale's son, Joseph, who was the co-owner of the slave ship Providence, and others who we have learned from census records owned enslaved people. Reverend Rowland continued to serve as minister here until 1774, which was the same year that the British Parliament passed the so-called Intolerable Acts, removing some of the colony's historic rights, including self-governance, and so the Continental Congress met in Philadelphia for the first time. The British occupation of Boston, which had already had the Tea Party, and the Boston Massacre. The British occupation of Boston had exiled a progressive minister named the Reverend John Lathrop to Providence. He was sort of a proto-Unitarian, and he served the congregation here uncalled during his exile from 1775 to 76 as the Revolutionary War began. Also in 1775, Congregational Church deacon, now Samuel Nightingale, supported the wish of Nancy Nightingale, who is identified in records as his Negro girl, in her wish for baptism and membership not into this church, but into the Baptist church, having consent from her master, as the church record puts it. The Baptists received her into baptism and membership there. where she stayed until 1785. Reverend Lathrop's return to Boston meant that the congregation was back to traveling ministers until 1783, a huge year for this church. The church welcomed its fifth called minister, the Reverend Enos Hitchcock, who served under George Washington. He had served under Washington as a military chaplain during the Revolutionary War. Reverend Hitchcock was also theologically progressive, and he continued that trend towards deeds rather than faith. He was one of the leaders in the movement to establish a public school system here in Providence, and he was also a fervent abolitionist. Also that year, the church revised their covenant for the third time. They removed the last remnants of Calvinist doctrine, but reinstated Trinitarian language. And they laid out an explicit commitment to live in charity with those of any faith if it was grounded in the sincere love of the Lord Jesus Christ. Reverend Hitchcock's 20-year tenure would be a time of growth and prosperity for the congregation. A year after his arrival, already beginning to feel the church more secure, the congregation finally lifted the censure of benevolent church across the way, which had been declared decades before. All the many long years of religious shunning was over, and open communion was established among all the Christian churches. And after a time, the congregation acquired land here at the corner of Benefit and Benevolent Streets for a new, larger meeting house. Meanwhile, down in Philadelphia, a man named Richard Allen had bought himself out of slavery in his early 20s and had become a Methodist Episcopal preacher. Repelled by the ordered segregation of black members in the congregation, he left. And in 1787, he established the Free African Society. It was a mutual aid society to assist fugitive enslaved people and other newcomers to the city. And this was the forerunner of what would become the African Methodist Episcopal Church. They purchased a blacksmith shop, which was the first home of their organization. And in 1794, they were officially incorporated as the First Bethel AME Church. Just a couple of years before, in 1790, Reverend Hitchcock had published Memoirs of the Bloomsgrove Family. It was a two-volume set of books in the form of a series of letters to a citizen of Philadelphia, outlining a number of Reverend Hitchcock's positions on issues of the day, including slavery. I want you to think about this, because at this point, many members of his church, surely the majority, and surely the majority of his wealthy members, were directly or indirectly getting all their income from the slave trade. And he's an abolitionist minister, which means that for him to say anything about this, he is risking his ministry and the church. And he made the decision to call it out nonetheless. In fact, his abolitionism was dauntless and absolute. "I cannot forbear," he wrote, "to express my astonishment at the inconsistency between the love of liberty which prevails in our country." Think about it, right? The Revolutionary War just ended. Liberty was the word of the day. "The love of liberty which prevails in our country and the practices of many individuals in enthralling their fellow creatures. Americans can write with precision upon the principles of liberty, yet many who can defend their own rights with one hand are extending the other for the purpose of enslaving a part of their own species. This is surely departing from the golden rule of doing as we would be done unto. How incompatible this commerce is with the character of a Christian people." Here in Providence, the congregation built the new building. The second meeting house was a striking twin-towered wooden structure. It was designed and constructed by a local architect, Caleb Ormsby, and it was completed by his firm in 1795. A couple of years later, in 1797, the church began to receive gifts of silver vessels to aid in serving communion. Mrs. Elizabeth Nightingale, who was married to Joseph, one of the sons of Samuel, gave three silver chalices. This is the silver that's down below the pulpit on the piano. All in 1797, Mrs. Mary Dexter gave another. Mrs. Mary Stiles gave another. Other female members combined their resources to give one more. And that chalice just says, given by female members, because I think it was heaps of them, and they couldn't inscribe them all on the chalice. But all those chalices are inscribed. I really encourage you to come up after the service and look at our communion silver. It is your communion silver. It is yours as much as anyone's from 1797 when it was handed to this community to now. It is yours to look at, yours to read, yours to see, yours to touch. Two large plates were also given. These were later combined into one by a vote of the church, and two fine and solid tankards complete the collection. They are uninscribed, and so we don't know when or how they became ours. Reverend Hitchcock completed his 20-year ministry in 1803. 2 years later, in 1805, the congregation called their sixth minister, Reverend Henry Eads, who came with his wife Catherine. The renowned Unitarian preacher William Ellery Channing was friends with Reverend Eads and spoke at the installation service, signaling the momentous trajectory of what would be Reverend Eads' 27-year ministry. The War of 1812 came and went. Mrs. Eliza Bowen gave another communion plate in 1813, which is there. In June of 1814, there was a devastating fire from arson, which destroyed the second meeting house in only its 20th year. Immediately, the congregation began planning a new meeting house, a stone meeting house. That same year, Mrs. Sarah Burl gave two elaborate communion chalices. In 1815, Reverend Eads laid the cornerstone. He must have been a strong guy. Reverend Eads laid the cornerstone for the new building, which had been designed by a local apprentice of Ormsby's, John Holden Green. While the building was underway, Elizabeth Nightingale led the founding and became the first president of the Female Benevolent Society in 1815. The initial Benevolent Society had bolstered the church institutionally. This society was to aid individuals in financial need, both within and beyond the congregation, and to assist the church in other ways as well. By 1816, the third meeting house, this meeting house, was completed and dedicated on October 31st of that year. While the church was being built, its theology was also under construction. William Ellery Channing preached his decisive declaration of Unitarianism in 1819 at the ordination of Jared Sparks in Baltimore, and his friend, our own Reverend Eads, with a whole delegation from this church, went down all the way to Baltimore, attended and supported that service down in Maryland. What an extraordinary sweep of time, of consolidations and divisions, of generosity and avarice, of evolution, lasting change, and cycles that repeated and repeated, all moving through human lives and relationships and history, so much that endured and so much that went up in flames only to rise literally like a phoenix from the ashes. Some people way ahead of their time and others way behind. So much we recognize, not least that age-old tug of war between faith and deeds, or as we put it today, between spirituality and social justice. That's right. It is still among us. Then, as now, often seen as opposed rather than parts of a whole. So much is behind this congregation, and so much is before us. Look around this space, and I mean it, don't look at me. Look at the pillars. Look at the entablature underneath this great dome and the extraordinary Corinthian columns that support it. All that work. Think of everything this space has heard and held, more than we will ever know. People fell in love in this room and in this congregation. People let each other down here. People stepped up. People fell. people took hold and people let go here. Knowing ourselves and each other means knowing our history. Our past informs our present. Our knowledge informs our vision. We are learning and we have more to learn. We are part of it all. And because we are here together now, we are shaping it all and doing all we can to make this beloved community, our church, and our time better because we have lived and because we have come together here and because we have loved within these storied walls. Amen.